You're listening to the Apple Insider Podcast.
Welcome to episode 85 of the Apple Insider Podcast. I'm your host, Victor Marks, and joining me today is Daniel Aaron Dilger.
Hello from San Francisco.
Welcome. So, Dan, you were our representative at the Apple event. How was it being at the event, and how was this event different than past events that you've attended?
This is the second time they've had a major event at the, it's called the Bill Graham Civic Auditorium. Bill Graham was a music producer. It's kind of a general sort of music venue, auditorium kind of space. And I believe last year, the first time they used it was for the iPad Pro and the new Apple TV. And I think they renovated the seating, so they made it quite a bit nicer. And they dropped the ceiling, and they really changed it from just a basic arena, it's right in the middle of San Francisco, next to City Hall, into a very kind of a nice spot. And they used it again for WWDC, both for the keynote and then for, they had a party afterward that they handled there, which was the first time for that. And so this was the second time that they've had, and the first time for an iPhone, that they've had at this particular venue. And there was a lot of production that went into it. I mean, it's a bigger space. There was a lot more journalists. I saw a lot of people from all over the world there, and you constantly see people talking in a different language. And the only thing that you can understand that they're saying is, you know, they're saying something, and then you hear them say iPhone 7. iPhone 7.
Yeah.
So it really shows how important the events that Apple's doing is on a global scale. Because, you know, we've been doing this for a long time, and it wasn't that long ago that it was journalists from San Francisco that would go to these events, and they weren't as big. And I think that's kind of one of the bigger things that kind of struck me is the amount of polish that Apple puts into it. And then one of the other things you noticed, I mean, not only is it a big stage show in a huge event, and, you know, they brought in Sia to perform, and she did a couple songs. And then afterward, when they did the hands-on, they've done what they've done a number of times in the last couple of years, where they built out an entire, basically like a pop-up retail store, where they show off the new equipment. And previously they've done this at the other venue closer to the Metreon in San Francisco called Center for the Arts, Yerba Buena. And there's a kind of a small building that's sort of reserved for event space. But here they've had to build it from scratch, basically, within the inside of this arena. And so they take sort of a back hallway, and the entire hallway is wrapped with white board and LED lighting. And that's just the hallway going into this event. And then inside the space, you have, it's very much like an Apple store, Apple retail store, where they have huge banners. And so there's a lot of effort going into kind of crafting an experience that kind of runs in parallel with the products that they're building and the story that they're telling about how to use it and who's using it and things like that. So it's kind of interesting to watch that evolve.
Let me ask you, I know that you've followed the development of Campus 2, the UFO, and we know that there's an underground auditorium for that. But I believe it's smaller than the Bill Graham. So do you think that future events will continue to be held in the Bill Graham, or are we going to see a return to holding events on Apple's campus?
I don't know for sure. I'm imagining that there will be certainly some events there. I mean, right now Apple hosts some of the events that I have attended. I mean, most notably on campus, they've had some events there. I'm trying to remember what the last product they launched at the Apple campus was. It was just recently. They've had two, and my brain is not working right now. That's where they have shareholder conventions. There's a small theater within the existing Infinite Loop Apple campus, and I'm trying to remember what the last two events were that I went to Cupertino were for. But both times it was hands-on products for an event. So Apple has alternated back and forth. Obviously, the iPhone is a huge event. And so it kind of pulls in too many people to fit into a small theater like that. And it's kind of hard to judge the sense of how large the underground theater is at the new Campus 2 site. It doesn't look very big when you're flying over with a drone or if you're looking at it from the sidewalk, but it probably is bigger than it. You know, in kind of construction, sometimes things look bigger and then they look smaller depending on how progress happens. But
so let's talk about the things that were announced. Clearly, we got iPhone 7 and 7 Plus, and some changes for those devices from their predecessors, and an Apple Watch. We actually got two variants of Apple Watch. We got the Series 1 and a Series 2 watch. And
yeah, the Series 1 is the carryover of the existing Apple Watch with an improved processor. And I ask how they describe that is they said it now has the, you know, the dual core processor that's in the modern the
Series 2 watch,
the new Series 2. And I ask specifically, does that mean that it has the same S2 package, or is it just a S1 with an upgraded processor? And they didn't have an answer for me, and they were going to answer it, and they didn't. But so that isn't totally clear for me if it has the same chip package or if it's just an upgraded version of
it got a dual core something, but we have no idea if it's exactly the same one that's in the S2 or what.
Yeah, and actually, now that I've said that out loud, it's quite clear to me that it's not the S2 because that's would also include GPS and other features that are new to the Series 2 model.
Right, because it's a whole system in a package.
Right. So it's apparently the S1 package upgraded to a newer, better processor.
Right, or it could be an entirely redesigned package that just happens to not have the GPS in it.
Yeah, S1.5 maybe.
Right. And they've done that before, right? You know, when they shipped iPad 2s for as long as they did, they revised the internals on those along the way. So this is not a huge thing if they have redone the entire layout just for a 1.5.
Yeah, and also I think the Apple TV had, they would call it the A4, but it kept getting smaller and it was like adjusted slightly or something, but yeah. So they can change the processor without changing the branding of it.
Yeah, and there was a third and a half gen Apple TV along the way. It's certainly not the first time they've revised things midstream. So, since we started talking about the watch, what were the big changes, and what were your favorite details among them?
So the current watch is water resistant. And I think they call it IP6, or they call it IPX7. And what that IP means is there's two numbers. One is dust resistance, and one is liquid resistance. And on the watch, they didn't specify a dust resistance, which doesn't mean that it's not resistant, but it means that they didn't test it or verify that it is a certain amount.
Yeah. So IPX7.
So I think they call it IPX7,
right,
or IPX6 or something like that?
Well, IPX7 is that the Apple Watch can withstand immersion in water up to 1 meter for up to 30 minutes.
Okay.
So, which means you're good for hand washing, you're good for a light shower. Prolonged exposure, like swimming, might be harmful to it.
Yeah. So I've had mine underwater, not diving, but I've actually swam with it on. In clear water, it's pretty safe, I think. I think it's bad to put it in salt water.
Yeah.
Because that's more corrosive. So the Series 2, which is what's new about it, is not only is it, it's actually good enough to swim in. I mean,
Well, it's intended for.
They don't give it an IP rating that I saw on the back of the watch. Instead, it says 50 meters, which 50 meters is quite deep. It's, 50 meters is 150 feet.
Well, so it's an interesting thing because I'm also a watch guy, and I've written for watch blogs. And the 50 meters rating, the meters rating that you see on water resistance on a watch is a static rating, right? That's for that pressure at that depth without any dynamic movement that would increase the pressure. And so what they say when they give out those watch ratings, the guidance is from watch manufacturers, you know, your Orients, your Seikos and people like that, is that 50 meters or 100 meters is suitable for hand washing. You know, 100 meters is suitable for hand washing and light swimming and car washes and things like that. But you're certainly not going to go diving with it. And the 50 meters is very much, you could do laps, but really it's hand washing. It's similar to that IPX7 rating in terms of the way that they think about it. And that's because, you know, they're used to doing gaskets with screw-on backs and screw-on crowns, and there are a lot of ingress points, right?
And yeah, water is so incredibly heavy that I'm not an experienced diver, but I've done some diving, and when you get down to 50 meters, I mean, it's you have to know what you're doing. It's very dangerous. So it's not a dive watch.
No.
You would take going down, but, you know, if you're swimming, it's great for that. So they've made a big improvement in water resistance, and not only in just improving the seals and stuff, but also the novel thing. One of the things we talked about was the fact the speaker is redesigned so that instead of filling up with water, it's designed to expel the water. And that works specifically with swim workouts. So when you start a swim workout, it turns the screen off. Because when a screen, whether it's an iPhone or an Apple Watch, if you have the screen wet enough, it doesn't respond to your touch because the capacitance of your finger and the environment changes so dramatically that the watch can't handle it. So if you're taking a shower and you're trying to navigate your watch, it doesn't work very well. You have to dry it off. You have to dry your finger off a little bit. So when you're doing a swim with a Series 2 watch, it's not designed to be used while you're swimming, which, of course, you wouldn't probably be doing anyway. So what you do, you start a swim exercise routine, you jump in the water, the watch screen itself turns off, and it goes into a special mode. And you can do your swim, and then when you finish or when you're checking your status, you turn the digital crown. And when you turn it enough, it kind of like wakes up the screen and it becomes usable again. And the speaker vibrates the water out of the speaker cavity. So it's pretty clever design.
It really is. And what I was thinking is that, you know, the guidance that I have in the manuals from wristwatches that I've had, from mechanical wristwatches that I've had, has been, you know, yes, we say 50 meters. No, don't really take it down to 50 meters.
Yeah.
Here, I feel like Apple is being a little bit more genuine about that rating. It really is rated to take it down. You know, you can go to the bottom of the deep end of the pool without worry kind of thing, where you wouldn't necessarily do that with a traditional watch rated to 50 meters.
And also talking about phones, Apple is kind of known for under-promising and over-delivering. And with water resistance, we've seen that. To where when they talked about the watch previously, they said kind of don't swim in it. When it is, you know, pretty safe to swim with a standard Apple Watch today, if you're not diving with it, you know, if you're just getting it wet. But Apple said, you know, it's kind of splash resistant and, you know, you could maybe wash your hands with it on. They're being very conservative in what they can do. And also iPhone 6S, the previous phone that introduced last year,
currently available.
Apple didn't make any promises about water resistance, but we know that they actually introduced quite a lot of seal technology to where you can actually splash a 6S. And I've seen people torture test them and they don't last. With deep immersion for a period of time, but they can handle being wet to some extent. They don't immediately die, which you think of with electronics. So it was kind of a half step towards water resistance already that Apple didn't say anything about. And, you know, the obvious comparison is Samsung. Samsung's been talking about water resistance, and it kind of has promised waterproofing.
Right. They've talked about this for 3 years on successive generations.
And this year, after 3 years of advertising this as being a unique feature, this year, Consumer Reports and another site that we report about, I can't think of the name offhand, but both of them tested water resistance on the Samsung phones, both the flagship S7 and the Note. Maybe it was the Active, which is supposed to be even more.
It's kind of rugged. That's the one with the ports that get sealed with the flaps and things, yeah.
Yeah, so they're both supposed to be water resistant. They're both supposed to be waterproof, and Samsung makes kind of contradictory claims about what the waterproofing is supposed to mean. But whatever it is, they're kind of exaggerating. And in multiple testing by different companies, they've all found that the phone either dies, or at minimal, the audio stops working and does not work ever again correctly. So
right.
That's not really what people would think of when they hear that it's waterproof.
So the Galaxy S7 is rated to IP68, and they say that it's IP68 certified. And you wrote this back on July 8th, that Consumer Reports said that it's not actually water resistant, and they bought two of them. And the failures were that the screen flashed green and other colors and stopped responding to touch, and that tiny bubbles appeared on the camera lenses.
Yeah, it's pretty serious. Pretty seriously not resistant.
Yeah. Samsung also claims that the active can survive drops up to 5 feet on a flat surface, but Consumer Reports didn't attempt to test those. Parallel tests by SquareTrade. SquareTrade offers third-party insurance for phones, so that if your phone gets damaged for almost any reason, or even lost or stolen, that SquareTrade will insure you for it. And they insure for, I think, 3 years as opposed to 2 years of AppleCare, for example. They tested, and they found that the claims for water-resistant were also inconsistent.
So, it really shows that claims are not all equal, and Apple is more conservative in what they're claiming, and Samsung is quite liberal in what they're suggesting that will happen. And it's more than just whether or not your phone's going to survive. If you have a bunch of pictures and data on your phone and you have a water immersion issue, you're probably going to lose that, and you're not going to get it again unless you have it backed up correctly. So, if you have a Samsung phone and you think you can take it to the pool and it dies, you've lost all your stuff. And even if Samsung gives you a new phone, you still lost your stuff. So it's really kind of a trust thing, and it turns into a satisfaction issue for people.
Absolutely.
But let's stop talking about Samsung for a while.
Well, I mean, they came out with a waterproof device, and now they're going out with a bang, and
they're going out with a flaming bang.
Well, yes, I mean they're fireworks, right?
Yeah. Somebody sent me a news report where somebody had claimed that their car caught on fire. They plugged their phone and their Galaxy S7 into I guess it was a Note 7.
Yeah.
Plugged into their phone to charge, and came back and their car was on fire.
Hey, I've had a fire in my car before due to a non-Apple 30-pin to lightning adapter. It's scary having a fire in your car as you're driving.
Yeah. That would be particularly scary. Also in airplanes, there's this talk about the FAA saying that they're considering banning the Note 7 because, you have a fire in an airplane, that's pretty serious.
Yes. Yes, it is. There's nowhere to pull over and park.
Yeah. And, there's a limited amount of air.
That too. Funny how that works. Yeah. When I had that 30-pin adapter.
And all the flights now are non-smoking and have been for some time.
Yes, they have. Although they still have ashtrays in the toilets.
Yeah, even in new planes. I don't think there's any countries that, international flights. I'm old enough to remember when people could smoke on international flights.
Me too.
It was so disgusting.
But I asked a friend, why do they have ashtrays on airplanes still? And he said the answer is that even when someone lights up and it's illegal to light up, and we know it is, you still got to have a safe place to put it out.
I guess that makes sense.
So that was the reason. Although I flew on an international flight recently, and there were ashtrays in the armrests. Do you remember the last time you saw ashtrays in the armrests?
Yeah. I was on a flight. I think it was the last time I went to Europe. And our flight got delayed, and we sat on the tarmac for an hour. And I was trying to charge up my phone. And I went into the bathroom and plugged into the shaver plug-in. And that was the only outlet in the plane, was in the bathroom. And so while we were sitting there, I just left it in there to charge. And I kind of hid it in the in the side, which is probably
not going well.
And the flight attendant, it was something like British Airways or something. The flight attendant was very proper and very upset, and was saying that we're going to turn the plane around and make everyone get
someone's
on.
Someone's left their phone unattended because it's unattended property and is a threat. Yes.
Well, at the same time, it did actually look kind of scary. It looked like a bomb because there are cables, and I think what it was, I plugged my battery in.
Oh,
so it probably looked suspect, but
first of all, the rule is you can't leave anything unattended anywhere because that's automatically suspect.
Yeah. So it was like a little bit sketchy in appearance, but fortunately the pilot was like, yeah, we're not going to turn around for this guy plugging his battery in. So it resolved, but there was a little bit of
Way to get the stink eye from everyone on the plane, Dan.
Yeah, that would be bad. I would probably have gotten arrested too.
For sure.
Charged with, like, they probably would have charged me how much fuel it cost in that plane.
No, but you would have gone to jail for making threats.
Or, yeah, something
ridiculous. Yeah, something like that. But
yeah, I would not want to understand what is involved in that sort of situation.
No.
So I will never do that again.
let's get back to talking about the Apple event and the products that came out of it, although I love hearing about your travels. So with the watch, we got the Series 1, the Series 2. The Series 2 is different how? We know it's got the dual core. What else?
It comes in a different finish. So instead of the sport aluminum, stainless steel, regular, and gold
edition,
now they're referring it to all of it as Series 2. There's a Series 2 aluminum, there's a Series 2 stainless steel, and there's a Series 2 white ceramic. And the advantage to white ceramic is that it's hard, and it's the same weight about as the stainless steel. It's harder than steel. It has an interesting look to it. I'm not sure what I think about it, because I've heard some people talking about it. I overheard John Gruber talking about it as being the very classic Apple look, and there was a huge banner on the side of the wall in the hands-on room, that, like this enormous ceramic Apple Watch. And it really does look like it kind of makes me think of an iPod from the early days of the 2000s.
Kind of like a third-gen iPod with that rounded profile to it.
Yeah. Yeah, a very kind of classic Ivy Jobs kind of product. Very, very minimal. And, you know, I tried it on. It also reminds me of, you know, Eve from Wally.
Mm-hmm. How much is the ceramic one going to go for?
It's like $1,100 and something.
Ooh.
I mean, it's kind of expensive compared to the other models. Where I don't... If it was the same price as stainless steel, I could see maybe opting for it. But I think, you know, for my finances, I think I would rather have stainless steel.
Uh-huh.
The stainless steel is now, what are the prices?
So in fact, the 42 millimeter ceramic is
$1,300. $1,300, okay.
With the sport band, by the way. So you get white ceramic with the sport silicone band for $1,300.
Yeah, so that's an interesting money. Level of premium tier.
The steel model. Let's see here. So the Series 2 aluminum case is $369 for the 38 millimeter. It's $399 for the 42 millimeter, and the stainless steel case begins at $549 and $649. There's also
the sport band.
Well, no, the stainless steel with sport band is $549. The saddle brown classic buckle is $649, and the modern buckle is $749 for the 38 millimeter, and the blue leather loop is $700 for the 42 millimeter. If you want the Milanese loop, then it's $649. If you want the link bracelet,
so it's kind of
you're talking $949. So you're already back up to the ceramic level.
I think those are kind of the similar price that the standard Apple Watch was before. And so the other new thing they do is they're selling the existing Apple Watch with a higher performance processor for in entry level price. It's what, $269?
Well, $269 is the 38 millimeter, but if you prefer the 42 millimeter, as many of us do, then you're looking at $300.
Okay.
It's a $299 price point for the 42 millimeter.
You know, I kind of like the smaller watch.
Do you really?
I do.
In the past, the smaller watch did not have as much performance as the 42 millimeter.
I don't know why it would have less performance.
There was a different processor involved for the
really?
Small, yeah.
Because it also has slightly lower resolution.
That too.
So I don't know how much a difference that would make in terms of like usability, but I have to catch myself. I've never seen a problem with overall performance on the watch. And
now that I have said
that out loud,
you're going to hear from
me. I'm not talking about apps. I'm not talking about launching apps. I'm talking about just the regular UI. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not, yeah, apps under watchOS 2 are terrible,
okay.
Like unusable virtually. But with my existing watch, with watchOS 3, apps are tremendously better. They're actually, you can actually use apps. So it's kind of like going to iPhone OS 2, you know, when they first came out. Mm-hmm. Instead of having sort of, you know, web apps that could sort of work, you have actual apps, and they work just like Mail and Safari on the phone.
Yeah.
So.
Now, some people have been suggesting that the original plan for the watch was that it was going to become the modern computing platform for everyone, and that the phone would even take a back seat to it, and that this event represents sort of a reset of that philosophy, and that instead we're seeing that if you care about health and you care about running, then the watch is for you. Otherwise, maybe not so much.
Well, I mean, that's maybe what they were saying, but that's never, ever what Apple has ever suggested.
Okay.
And it doesn't make any sense. I mean, why would Apple say, you know, we're making however many billions of dollars they make on iPhones. Hey, let's make a smaller product that costs less, that is going to make us less money, and replace the iPhone with it. You know, I mean,
right. I think the people
stupid.
That are saying that are the same people that suggest that the iPhone has sort of run its course as far as innovation can go, and that we're pretty much in just refine and maintain for the iPhone.
Well, they're also saying that phones in general in the future are going to cost $100, and you know, no, that has not been. They've been saying that for quite some time now.
Mm-hmm.
They've been saying Android is going to take over because it's cheaper, and no, it hasn't. It has not. And there's a huge and increasing market for Apple's premium phones that cost so much more than everyone else's phones that it's hard to even understand how it is that there's so many people on Earth that are paying a huge premium for an iPhone. It's almost difficult for me to understand. And I'm not often accused of being...
You're not often at a loss for words.
Well, also, I'm not often accused of like not understanding Apple's premium business model.
Yeah. So, where do you think what do you think the watch is for, and who should buy one?
Well, for me, having used the watch over the last year. I have to say that I don't use watches. I've never used a watch. I have never really wanted to wear a watch. It's not like a fashionable thing of like, I want to put a watch on me. The last time I remember wearing a watch was in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And having started wearing the watch just kind of because Apple made it, basically, is why I started putting it on. I wire it every day. And if I leave the house without it, if I take a shower, take it off, and don't put it on, I feel like there's something wrong. I have a couple times, you know, I had this situation with surgery last month. I was in the hospital for a couple weeks, and I didn't have a watch charger. I went into the emergency room without even a phone charger, and ended up getting hospitalized for this whole period of time. And fortunately, Apple Insider sent me a watch charger, so I could have my watch.
We sprung for a watch charger. Very
yeah,
good.
I survived. But going for even a few days without it, I also had my watch serviced at one point. And so there's a couple times in the last year that I haven't had it. And I found myself looking at my wrist repeatedly, even though I knew that I didn't have it. It was just, it became so ingrained. And it's not just, you know, a fetish of having something on your wrist. It's because it's useful. You want to know the time. That's the most useful thing. And also navigation or notifications are the big reason to have a watch. And then also I track activity. So I love data. And so seeing data about myself has been incredible. And being able to track things. This year I have tracked my heartbeat and my weight and body composition in ways that I have never done before in my life. And it's, to me, it's really interesting, and it's actually made a huge difference in my health.
I was going
just
to ask
understand
that
what I'm doing.
You know, what has changed about your health as a result of that?
Well, I went on a cruise in January this year, and I showed up and I was like, what's wrong? My clothes don't fit. And then, you know, it was this a week of all you can eat kind of stuff. And I was thinking, wow, I'm really slacking off, and I can't do this. You know, I'm trying to get to the point where, you have to take care of your body when you get old. And so I came home and started I kind of restarted the exercise that I had been doing. I've been kind of slacking off, and was also changing my diet and tracking my diet and paying more attention to what I was eating. And I was using a lot of health kit stuff. So there's an app called Lose It that tracks what you eat. It makes it pretty easy to record what you're eating, which otherwise, you know, without some help is kind of difficult to have a sense of how much you're eating and how many calories you are. The watch tracks your calorie burn, tracks your exercise, tracks your heartbeat and your activity level. So you get feedback and you get, I spend a lot of time in front of the computer. So if I don't have somebody reminding me to get up and do things, I sit there for hours and don't move. And that's really bad for you. And so having something that actively reminds you, hey, stand up and go do something, and you have 700 calories to burn and you're behind, so, you know, go outside and have a walk, you know, do an exercise session. That kind of constant mindfulness about health helped me lose, I lost about 15 pounds for 75. I lost like close to 20 pounds. And then this summer, I was kind of, I hurt something in my back, and it was kind of hard to keep up my exercise. And I was kind of reaching a plateau. And then, of course, I went into surgery and was on this basically a fast. I mean, they wouldn't let me eat, and came out, I lost another 15 pounds. So I'm weighing what I weighed in high school now all of a sudden. But, you know, you feel a remarkable difference when you're active and when you're eating better and when you're aware of what we're dealing with your body. And being an American, I try pretty hard. I'm not like, you know, full on eating junk food American, but still in America, we have this sort of culture that we've developed over the last several decades of eat a bunch of junk and don't worry about it. And then just like chug down a bunch of antacid. And, you know, it's kind of funny to not exercise, and it's killing us. And that's why we have, diabetes and why we have these things. And when you're around healthcare and you see the actual impact that having diabetes is not only, you know, a difficult thing to deal with, it has drastic impacts on your health and your body. It's a really serious deal. And so taking, you know, having any kind of electronics attached to your body that are giving you feedback about what's happening really is going to make a huge difference in your life going forward. And I think Apple has really capitalized on that. And of course, there's other companies. There are companies that were coming out with smartwatches years before Apple, and they had some of these things on them. There were activity trackers that, you know, Fitbit came out, I don't know how many years before Apple Watch, but, you know, there were things available before then. I had a heart monitor watch, mm-hmm. that was kind of a cheap thing that I don't know how accurate it was, but I didn't wear it all the time. And you know, I put it on while I was doing an exercise routine, and I had a chest strap thing. It was like a Bluetooth chest strap,
yeah,
that I was trying to review for, like doing exercise. It was a health kit enabled device, but it wasn't, you know, obviously you can't wear it all the time. So the watch, getting your pulse from your wrist is not, especially the top of your wrist, is not the best way to get a pulse.
Yeah. You'd want to do it from the bottom of your wrist.
Yeah. I mean, that came out recently when Apple was talking about some of the executives, I can't remember the source of the thing, but it was basically saying that when they were designing the watch, they were...
It was an engineer who had left Apple, yeah, and was talking about his experience as being a part of the product team.
Yeah. So, you know, optimally, if you're taking your pulse, if you go to the hospital, they do it on the end of your finger. But that's not something you're going to walk around wearing. And it would be better to have the watch face on the bottom of your wrist, but that's not how people wear watches. So it is, you know, a little bit of a compromise to make something that actually works. And there are occasions when I will notice, in talking about the accuracy of the heart monitor on the watch, every time I've had my vitals taken, which, like when I was in the hospital, happened several times a day, I would look at my watch and look at what the oximeter on my finger was saying, and they were remarkably accurate. So the watch is actually good at doing what it does as it's designed. However, I've also noticed doing exercise routines, particularly when you're doing like a floor exercise, when you're doing P90X or you're doing yoga or something like that, frequently will say, you know, my heart will be racing and I'll be having sweat just dripping off me. And I'll look down, my watch will say my heartbeat is 50.
Right. And I'm like, so are you kidding me? It's half of what it actually is, right?
Yeah. And it almost always, it gives you half.
Yeah.
And you adjust the thing a little bit and then it's like, oh no, wait. Oh, it's 100, you know, it's 150 or whatever. So yeah, there are points at which it's not telling you the exact number of heartbeat palpitations or whatever. But, I would like to have a better sense of how to make them more accurate. I think there's some interesting things they can do with the watch. WatchOS 3 introduces that new Breathe app, which is sort of also an interesting way to monitor health or kind of actively change what's happening with your bodies, where you're kind of focusing and calming your breath while it's also checking your heart rate. The new swim exercise routine, I haven't tried it yet, so that'll be interesting to see how that works and get kind of a sense of how well it monitors your heart rate or whatever it does. I was also thinking one thing I'd like Apple to have on the watch is a sleep mode where you wear your watch at night. You don't have to charge your watch all night because it doesn't take that long to charge it up. So if they had a sleep exercise mode, basically, where you turn it on, you go to bed, and it monitors your sleep, and it doesn't, you know, currently with the existing watch, if you put it on and you put it into a general exercise mode, it will definitely wear down the battery within 5 hours, maybe three, because it uses a lot of power to constantly monitor your heartbeat. But if it was just active, you know, like conservatively actively monitoring your heartbeat and movement and things like that to give you feedback on your sleep quality, there's apps that do that on your phone. So I would kind of like to see Apple do that with the watch. So you could actually wear it at night and then, you know, some point during the day, you could plug it in for an hour and have it charged up all the time. But, yeah, so that's one of the things on my, I'm writing up a wish list of things I would like to have different.
Definitely. Well, I would like to talk about the phones now. We've spent some time on the watch. Let's talk about the other thing that was announced. So there's an iPhone 7, there's an iPhone 7 Plus, and the iPhone 7 Plus got a dual camera, it got more RAM, and it one of the interesting things that I saw was that developers are being allowed access to features that were previously Apple only, like the Taptic Engine now has an API. So help me fill in the gaps of the things that I just said. I know I covered it lightly. What's missing? What was it covered in the event that I didn't talk about yet?
Well, we could talk about the Taptic Engine and the home button, which has changed. That was number two, I think, in the list of things. So currently the home button that we're all familiar with, the Touch ID, is a fingerprint sensor, but it also clicks in when you press it.
It's a mechanical switch currently.
Yeah, and it you can feel the what's the word for it, that it's going in, the depression. It's like pressing a key on a keyboard.
Yeah.
And on the new phones, there's no movement. So when you touch it, it has kind of a foreign feel to it. But when you feel like you're touching it, it vibrates in a way that you get this kind of feedback that's different. It doesn't feel like a press, but it's kind of like same but different.
So on the current MacBook Pro, they've got the Taptic Engine as a part of the trackpad.
Right.
And it's not actually moving, but it certainly feels like it clicks.
Yeah, so this is very similar. So you can tell that it's not actually being depressed, but at the same time, you have that feedback to where it kind of feels like it is. So there's a slight adjustment in your brain about what's happening, but it's a similar experience. And the end result for users is that, A, you're, it's slightly different, but it still works the same. And B, it's not a physical thing that can wear out. So that's better in that respect. And I'm sure it also makes the device, helps to make it thinner.
But it also contributes to its being water resistant.
Yeah. So there's less egress for fluid. So, and it may be a half step towards a phone in the future that doesn't have a button at all. just has a area of the screen that you press on and vibrates like you have a virtual button.
So there's just to read through a little bit of the list on it. There's an A10 Fusion processor, which has four cores. And interestingly, you know, it's been a long time since we've had a real demonstration about the cores in a product. You know, I think back to Macworld 2000 or Macworld 2001, where John Rubinstein got up on stage and talked about how the PowerPC handled instructions going through its cores. And we got a nice little animation as a slide going back then. We haven't had one of those for a long time. And in this keynote, we got a demonstration of the Fusion processor, where there are two cores that are doing the heavy lifting and two more that are conserving battery by running very slowly.
I have two things to say about that. One is, it's interesting that their use of the Fusion brand name, because previously they've used Fusion to refer to their solid state SSD combination hard drive.
Yeah.
So it's basically two different technologies. One is good at being fast, and one is good at being having a lot of capacity. So you're putting them together, and it's a hybrid. So this is a similar sort of sense of, here's a hybrid processor where it's fast chips that are efficient, and or fast chips that are going to be less efficient, but they're more powerful.
Right.
Or cores. And then there's like less powerful cores, but they're more efficient. So it's a very similar hybrid sort of branding. Of course, that's not unprecedented. And in fact, everyone else in ARM is doing that. Samsung has been advertising for many years about how many cores they have. And the reason why they have so many cores, they have 8 core processors for a couple of years now, is because the generic design that ARM came out with was 2 sets of cores. One is high power, one is low power. Apple has always had 1 or 2 cores. And their optimization of software means that in many tasks, there's a whole lot of tasks that are not possible to stretch across multiple cores. And in fact, most of what you're doing on a cell phone is on a single core. And if you're doing multiple things at once, sometimes you can do things in parallel, or you can have a task that's using both processor cores at once. But that's a little bit of a stretch. And so, you know, for Samsung to advertise that their processor has 4 cores, there's 2 problems with that. One is that there's not much software that can actually take advantage of 4 cores at once. And Android is not very good at it in general in scheduling that. And the second thing is that you have a certain amount of die space. So you have finite resources on your chip. If you split it up into 4 instead of 2, that means each of those cores is going to be smaller. And so if most of your software is only using 1 core, instead of using half of the chip, like what Apple's been doing, it's only using a quarter of the chip. So, you know, everyone's been in Android land has been kind of enthralled about Samsung having so many cores. That's actually not a good thing. But talking about what Apple's doing with the Fusion, they are, you know, in a sense, they are copying this idea that ARM came out with for having 2 sets of cores that work in tandem, one being more powerful, one being much more efficient. So it's interesting that Apple is moving from what their historical design of 2 cores to 4 cores. And in the chip picture that they showed, they're not 4 cores of the same size. There's 2 small cores and 2 larger cores. So it's very much a hybrid design between taking some of the advantage that Samsung has talked about with having 2 sets of cores, and at the same time capitalizing on the fact that Apple's still focusing on single core performance and having only 2 cores, 2 powerful cores as opposed to 4, and then having overall 4 cores that can work in tandem or as alternating between the two, as opposed to splitting a chip into 8 cores.
Right.
So
Tell me about the camera, because the camera was a big part of the news too. And I use the iPhone camera all the time. In fact, it's my primary and pretty much only camera for shooting for us.
So yeah, mobile cameras, every year Andrew's better things, and the things that make a mobile camera better are having a wider aperture, so you're letting more light in, having bigger pixels, so that each pixel can get as much light as possible and can give better data, so that you don't have crosstalk between them, and so you don't have the kind of blurring weirdness in color. And there's a couple other things in terms of like color accuracy and ability to focus. They use pixels to determine whether something, whether it's in focus or not. So all those technologies are kind of incrementally moving forward, and Apple has capitalized on, you know, the things that have changed in the last year to improve the camera. The camera is getting bigger, so there's actually more of a bulge than there was last year that was introduced in the 6. And one of the other huge pictures on the side of the test wall, or the hands-on Apple Store pop-up at the event, was a picture, kind of this glamorized picture. It's on the web, their website, I believe, too, that shows a close-up of the iPhone 7, and it almost exaggerates the camera bulge into a volcano.
Wow.
And it really shows that Apple does not give, does not care at all about the contempt that has been spewed in its direction by people who are talking about how ugly the camera bulge is, which is kind of weird because, you know, certainly all the premium Android phones have camera bulges. And the reason they do is because having some lens makes a dramatically better camera. So, I mean, the goal of having a flat back is one thing, but, you know, everything is a trade-off. If you look at any engineering trade-off, you have to be reasonable about what the cost-benefit ratio is. And if you say, oh, it should be flat, well, yeah, ideally it would be not having anything sticking out, so it lays flat on its case. But when it comes down to whether or not you're going to have good pictures or not, I think the design choice of having a bulge coming out the back that probably is not even evident if you have a case on it, mm-hmm, is a much better design decision than saying, oh, we made back flat, but your pictures are going to be terrible.
Absolutely. Now, they also improved the flash, and it's so that it's got 4 LEDs instead of the former 2 LEDs. And there was a cool feature they talked about there with indoor lighting. Do you remember that feature?
Yeah, it relates to the flicker. If you take a picture in a place where there's LED lighting, particularly, because LEDs, it's kind of like a movie. It's when, to your eye, an LED looks like it's solid, but it's actually light. It's actually flashing, and it's flashing because the power going through it is going two directions, and an LED, the D in LED is a diode, it can only go through one direction. So it's actually turning on and off every time the electrons change direction. So it's actually flashing, what, 60 times a second in the United States?
U.S. is 60 hertz power, yeah.
Yeah, so if you take a photograph of something that's illuminated with LEDs, you usually have this kind of weird waviness, because as the camera is taking the picture, it kind of takes it like a, you know, slides from across the screen. As it's collecting the data, it's dealing with the light turning on and off, basically. And so it you end up with a ripple effect. So they're accounting for that and helping get rid of it by taking a picture differently. And that applies to LED lighting, and also I would imagine it applies if you're taking a picture of a CRT or something like that, because that also, if you've ever taken a picture of an old television, the thing repaints the screen.
Yeah, you see the interlacing.
Yeah. So that was kind of an interesting thing. Well, and LED lighting is becoming more and more popular.
It's definitely becoming more prevalent as a part of Apple's HomeKit installations as people start buying in HomeKit lighting.
Yeah.
And the other thing is that so both cameras got, I think, similar sensors, right? They both are 12 megapixel. They both have the deep troughs between the pixels to help eliminate some of the crosstalk. They both have image stabilization, which formerly was a 6S Plus feature and a 6 Plus feature. And
yeah, that's the physical,
right?
The actual lens can bounce around to counteract the fact that your arm is jerking.
Yeah.
Or that you're shaking, micro shaking.
But the 7 Plus has a dual lens system, which is new. There's a wide angle and a telephoto both. Is that right?
Yeah. So there's the two sensors, I believe, are identical, and one has a lens that's identical to the 7, which is called a wide angle, and the other has a 2x telephoto lens on it, and it's has high enough quality to where I always avoid doing digital zoom, which in digital zoom you're basically just cropping the picture.
Yeah.
So you're taking the picture that it's going to give you, and you're just automatically throwing away part of it to look at a blow up of the inside of that picture. So when you do a digital zoom, you might as well take the picture and just crop it later, because mm-hmm. it's the same number of pixels. It's not any better.
Right.
But when you do an optical zoom, you're actually using a lens to focus the light on the same focus different light on the same sensor. So you're actually it's like putting a pair of binoculars in front of your sensor so that it's actually seeing further.
Right.
And so you get a sharp picture that's twice as far away. But then they demonstrated this, you know, tremendous digital zoom that I haven't actually played with it, so I can't verify that it's as good as they're portraying it. But it looks like because the image sensor is increased so much that you're actually able to zoom in quite dramatically based on what they've shown. So I'm really curious to see how well that actually works.
Right. They showed up to 10x for the digital zoom. And in the past, I've used products like the Exo lens or the Oloclip, which are accessory lenses that snap on over the existing iPhone lens in order to do telephoto or macro or things like that. Having it built in means having a higher quality lens and not having the different vagaries of light and size and magnification and sort of fisheyeing that you can get from the accessory lenses.
Yeah, I mean, a 2x lens is not tremendous for optical lens. And these lens packs, you can get them on Amazon for now like $10 or something.
Well, they're the good ones free. Cost more.
Yeah, but even like the basic ones are quite good, and they're tremendously better. You know, the lens built onto a mobile device is plastic. It's like plastic lenses. These are even the cheapest ones are pretty decent quality glass element lenses. So you can get fisheye lens. Usually there's a package of like a fisheye lens, and then you unscrew an element, it turns into a broad wide angle lens.
Yeah.
And then sometimes they have a telephoto. And those lenses are fun, but they're kind of a hassle to carry around because, you know, when you want a lens, it's like carrying around a DSLR or even a point and shoot. It's like when you want to take a picture, you probably don't have your camera with you. So it's good to have a camera, another lens built in. And they're also doing another interesting thing with the two lenses that they call a portrait. So it's going to be like a new type of photo that you can take between, you know, standard and square and Fano and now portrait. So it takes the two lenses and does a 3D model to kind of knock out the foreground. So if you're taking a picture of a person, you use the telephoto lens to focus on a person instead of a scene with a wide angle. And then it uses the two lenses to calculate where the person ends and the area around the background, it does a blur on. So it creates a nice portrait where you kind of pop out from your background. So that was really interesting. That's going to be delivered shortly after the phone ships.
Right. And what they're doing is basically the equivalent of shallow depth of field, like you'd see with a 50mm lens, which is like what I think the telephoto is meant to be, is a 50mm.
I was kind of hoping, I was kind of expecting that they would do more in terms of being able to use the two lenses for more kind of 3D sort of imaging and things. So, but that may actually be in the pipeline. I mean, there's a lot of times that Apple has shipped hardware and the software to really exploit it has taken longer to finish. And, you know, we're seeing that with the watch. I bought a watch a year ago, and WatchOS 3 is making it dramatically better.
Nothing says they're done yet, right?
Interesting things beyond portrait in terms of what they can do with those two lenses together.
Definitely.
Because remember, Apple bought PrimeSense and a number of other companies that is kind of related to using two lenses to do interesting things. So it'll be cool to see what else they release for that.
So let me ask, just opinion, the best news out of the event for you. What do you think it was?
I think the most ground-changing is the iPhone 7, obviously, because that's the device you use all the time. You always carry it. I'm a little bit torn about whether I need a new watch. I don't do GPS tracking when I do runs. I mean, I don't really do runs because I have bad knees.
Yeah.
But if I wanted to do runs, you know, I could do it on my phone. So I'm not quite desperately interested. I'm not a huge swimmer. So I'm not blown away by the Series 2. It's definitely a incremental advance in the watch, and I think a lot of people are going to appeal to more people even. WatchOS 3 is, to me, is more interesting than the new hardware. The phone is dramatically faster, dramatically better camera, like all the things that matter. And the other thing that we haven't touched on yet is the article that I wrote about wide color, which it was kind of obvious. I mean, I can't really take much credit for having like pointed this out in advance, but when we saw the iPad Pro come out this summer, the standard 9.7 inch version, it had a dramatically better screen. And if you look at it by itself, there's something about it that's nice, but you don't really get how much better it is until you compare it to another good quality screen, like the old iPad Pro or another iPad or an iPhone. It's able to reproduce colors that other screens cannot do yet or haven't been able to do yet. And they call it wide color. It's a wider color gamut. And it's actually quite strikingly dramatic when you look at pictures that are captured with wide color, and the new cameras on both the front-facing and the rear camera on the iPhone 7 capture full wide color photos. And Instagram, we did an article on this. Instagram is supporting that in reproducing photos that you share. They make the photos are much more vibrant. And I think that's going to be it's the kind of thing that you don't particularly notice. It's almost kind of like the Retina display, where when you look at it, you're just like, wow, this is really good.
Right.
But until you really investigate, you don't understand why it's good. It's good because the resolution is so much higher.
Right. And it's one of those things where you once you experience it, going back is where you notice it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, when you go back. Like if I'm working on an iPad Pro and then you go back to your phone, it feels like flatter. It feels like something's missing.
If you're working on a Retina MacBook and you go back to a MacBook Air and you notice the difference.
Oh, totally. Yeah. So it's that kind of big change.
Cool. Well, let me ask personally, which one are you going to get?
I'm going to get a Pro because I wanted that camera.
Plus.
The Plus. The 7.
What color?
7 Plus. I'm pretty sure I got to get the jet black if I can get a hold of one because not only is it like the new thing and the shiny, but also it's actually so shiny that the back is a mirror. So unless you put a case on it, like a big heavy case, you can use it to take selfies with your camera. So you get like a much better quality picture.
They advise you in the small type on Apple's site that it may scratch and that you may want to use a case on it to protect it. But
yeah, definitely it's going to scratch. I mean, you know, it's a world of real devices that we live in. Yeah. Physics apply.
So
I always think it's interesting when people talk about Apple, like it's because it's Apple, the world of physics does not apply and there's no abrasion and, you know, things can't wear.
Well, had they made it out of ceramic...
Yeah, right? I mean, perhaps the rumors are the next phone is going to be glass, and actually jet black looks like glass. I keep saying that it looks like it's glass, and it kind of feels like glass. And I think in my brain I'm saying that it feels like glass because it's shiny, but in reality it looks like polished. It looks like painted metal.
Yeah,
like really high quality painted metal, like chromed metal, where it's painted with a
almost
anodized
plated
finish. Because of course that's what it is. It's anodized.
Yeah.
But it has that kind of slipperiness to it that isn't slippery in terms of like you can't hold it.
No, it's grippy because it's so polished.
Yeah, it has this kind of slick feel. You know, it feels like a piece of chrome. But in my brain, because it's so shiny, it feels like glass. So it'll be interesting to see in the future if they actually find a way to develop something that works like glass that's... you know, I mean, they've been working with sapphire. The back of the watch is sapphire. the fancier watches. So glass is basically a... I did that article on Campus 2 and how the advanced glass that they're doing. They're working with this company in Germany that does huge sheets of optically pure glass.
Right.
And they're using it
structurally. They had to work to how to do it in curves, in compound curves like that, something they hadn't done before.
And they're super thick. And, you know, it's obviously a different set of engineering expertise to do that as opposed to a device, but they're related in the sense of glass is becoming a... We think of glass as being sort of like this fragile window thing, but glass is silicon, so in a lot of ways it's similar to ceramic. I mean, it's this sounds really dumb when it's coming out of my mouth, but building things out of ceramic, or, you know, we can make them translucent now. So a case out of glass isn't... When you first hear a case out of glass, you think, oh yeah, I'm going to drop it, it's going to shatter. But there's a lot of things that we build that are... There's a lot of cheap drinking tumblers that you can drop on the ground and they don't shatter.
Yeah.
Well, I think it would be kind of cool to have a case, if you could make it thin enough, that's out of some translucent material that's super hard and super strong, that you could have the insides visible, you know, like a Bondi iMac.
The old iMac.
Yeah.
Not the Bondi iMac. Go for the second gen iMac. Like the
smoky clear one?
The smoky clear one, or the iMac DV, that generation.
They could go back to candy colors.
You get flower power, I'll get blue Dalmatian.
I don't know about the printed ones. They were kind of stupid, but
they'd run out of ideas at that point. They were just holding.
And they wouldn't be able to sell cases because you wouldn't, you know, if they make them good enough, you won't have to buy a case.
Yeah.
It'd be like a watch that just like sticks on you without needing a band. They would like lose all that business right there.
Mm.
And all their partnerships. It is kind of interesting with the watch. I mean, going back to the watch, that they're forming these partnerships with Nike and Hermes and whoever's next to get other people selling their watch.
Hermes.
Yeah.
Hermes Double Tour would be very nice. I'd go for that. So the last thing that we haven't talked about is related to the iPhone, and it is where Apple's taken something away. They took away the headphone jack, and they took away the cords.
Well, there's still a cord, and now there's an extra cord because there's an extra dongle in there. If you want to plug in your old headphones, you can plug it in via a dongle.
Okay, so there is an adapter that allows you to connect traditional headphones to the Lightning jack. There are headphones with a cord that have a Lightning connector on them. Am I right so far?
Yes.
Keep me straight. But also, there are wireless headphones that have no cord at all and instead go in a little tic-tac-shaped box that charges via Lightning.
Yes. And the actual case contains a battery as well.
Right. So the case contains a battery and charges the headphones. And these are called AirPods, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And basically the way they work is they've got a battery inside them, they've got microphones inside them, and they've got, of course, speakers inside them, and a new wireless chip called W1. And what is W1 doing that's different from Bluetooth?
So it's doing Bluetooth, and it's doing standard Bluetooth. It works with other devices. It can work with, you know, a PC or an Android phone or whatever. But it, if you use it with a non-Apple device, it's a regular Bluetooth thing. And the problem with, you know, a couple of the problems with Bluetooth is that to set it up, there's this kind of back and forth
the pairing
process.
Model.
And then to go from one device to another, you have to set it up, and then you have to disconnect it, and then you have to reconnect it to another device. So it's kind of... There's kind of a clunkiness when dealing with Bluetooth, especially moving between devices. I have a Bluetooth speaker that, you know, if I'm playing my music through my phone and somebody else wants to use it, then I have to think, oh, now how much unplugging and replugging do I have to do? I have to disconnect mine, and they have to reconnect theirs. I have to show them how to connect to it. So what Apple's done with the AirPods is on the devices they can control, they've super simplified it to where it automatically logs in and
you push a button and it's connected to your phone. And then if you have want to use them on your iPod, or your iPods, or your iPads, or your Mac, or whatever,
anything that you have your iCloud account signed into,
right? So it uses iCloud to basically share the authentication, so you can just move it around really simple and easy, and you can even plug it into your watch. So that's a real kind of layer of user improvement on top of Bluetooth, but it is basic Bluetooth. So what W1 is, I mean, W is for wireless, obviously. It's a custom chip for doing wireless. Typically, Apple has used off-the-shelf components from other companies, whether it's Broadcom or whoever else.
CSR or, yeah.
Yeah, so they do Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and whatever. And they haven't detailed everything that's on this Bluetooth chip, but I would assume that it does Bluetooth and Wi-Fi both, because Bluetooth 4 has two things on it. One is Bluetooth LE, which is the low power version of Bluetooth that actually comes from Wibri or whatever. It's not, there's like classic Bluetooth that was on the Nokia phones that had a lot of shortcomings, and Bluetooth LE is actually a different standard, but they call it Bluetooth just cause for branding purposes.
Well, the low energy standard came a part of the Bluetooth 4 spec.
Yeah, so
that
it was
it's still the same special spec. Interest group. It's just that BLE is a different spec,
but it was technology developed by another firm,
yes.
By another group. I think it was Wibri is what they were branding it, and then that fell apart, and that became part of the Bluetooth 4 spec. So it's actually not Bluetooth, but it's now Bluetooth.
By any other name, I mean.
I mean, it's like if you replaced Flash with HTML5, and then you called it Flash. Well, it's not Flash. It's HTML5. But if you rebranded it Flash 2, then, you know, it's Flash, I guess. So it's actually a different standard than the classic Bluetooth. So they distinguish between classic Bluetooth and Bluetooth 4 LE, which is low energy. And then there's another standard that's kind of similarly folded into Bluetooth called, what is it called? You don't hear about it as much, but it was part of, I think it was Bluetooth 3, but it was developed as part of a standard called Universal Wireless.
Right.
It was kind of like It was kind of like the version of USB for wireless.
Well. So the point of 3 was that you had Bluetooth and it also had Wi-Fi rolled in, and so
yeah,
you
so
could
that's what I'm
you could get
about.
High data over it because it would start the Bluetooth.
Yeah, HS. That's what it's called.
Yeah.
So HS is a feature that kind of got folded in, which is also not Bluetooth at all, but it's basically using Bluetooth to set up a connection, and then it jumps over to Wi-Fi hardware so that you actually have a lot of throughput, because
right.
Bluetooth in any specification is not very fast.
Well, it was meant as
so
a personal area network. It was never supposed to carry a whole lot
right.
of data.
Yeah. So Bluetooth was intended to be sort of a replacement for serial ports, RS-232 serial. So it wasn't designed for massive throughput, but for things like continuity, and anything that you use modern Bluetooth for, you actually want it to be pretty fast. And so to achieve that, you jump to Wi-Fi hardware. So it's kind of like this hybrid. It's kind of like Fusion Wireless. But whatever, it's all these different technologies are now part of Bluetooth 4, even though they're somewhat unrelated. So I would imagine that the W1 chip does Bluetooth and also does Wi-Fi, because that's kind of part of the standard, is having that hardware. But it's a custom VLSI chip that Apple has developed on its own, very similar to, you know, the S series or the A series. They've actually done a lot of their own optimizations on it, and so it's specific to what they want to do. And that's interesting for a couple of things. One is they can use it for other things now. So the first thing that they've used it in is their own AirPods, and they've announced that Beats, which is their subsidiary, it's part of Apple, but they're using it in all their new wireless products, ranging from the low end to the high end to the middle.
Beats Power 3, Beats Solo Wireless 3, whatever, yes.
And probably in the future, they're going to be using it in other products as well. I mean, obviously, they're going to be using it in other products. But it shows a lot of the increasing vertical...
Do you think it's something that they'll license out to third party headphone manufacturers?
Probably not. I mean, they've never shared the A4 with anybody. I mean, the A-series devices and A-series chips, there would be a market for that. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of companies that would like to have a high-efficiency ARM chip.
Right. Well, I was thinking in terms of them allowing Lightning accessories, they've done that through the MFI program, and certainly they have MFI headphones via the Lightning connector. So why not license the W1 out as well?
It's possible. I think it's probably less likely now that Apple owns Beats. I mean, they paid $3 billion for a headphones company. They're probably not going to share their crown jewels with other companies. But they'd want connectivity with other companies' products. So if you're building a competitive pair of headphones, they may even be better than Apple's. They may have like higher response. They may have fancier digital audio converters or whatever. Apple wants those kind of devices in its ecosystem, so they're going to license the ability to use Lightning ports. So you can plug it into an iPhone, but I think they have much less reason to license their own custom chips.
Okay.
There's probably all kinds of trade secrets in that.
Let me ask another question. Since they make Beats, and we know that Beats is sort of a mid-range level headphone, are they going to make a high-end headphone?
I mean, they'll probably see where the demand goes. I mean, also, that's very relative. I mean, what is high-end? If you look at phones, what's a high-end phone? There are Android phones that sell for tens of thousands of dollars because they're encrusted with diamonds or whatever. Apple has no interest in making anything like that because
in terms of sound,
the demand for that is so small that it doesn't make any sense. But if you look at the iPhone, like we were talking about earlier, ASPs of iPhones are $650. The ASP of the phones that people are, the Android phones people are actually buying, are, I think Samsung's are around 250, and you know they talk about all these phones in China that are being built, but they're like $100 ASPs. Like on average, they're selling for $100. So, you know, if you talk about where the premium market is, Apple is really good at knowing how to target the premium market that matters. And that'll probably also show up in other things. So you're talking about headphones. You know, there are audiophiles that will pay insane amounts of money for really fancy headphones, but there's not that many of them. Whereas, you know, if you look at Beats, you can call it sort of moderate level stuff, but that's where the sweet spot of the higher end market is headphones that cost, you know, headphones that cost around $300. That's kind of fancy. I mean, it's not expensive compared to a lot of things, but there's a diminishing return on how fancy you can get before you don't have anybody that's going to pay that much money for it.
You can get a much better headphone for the same amount of money as you can buy a Beats headphone. You know, you can get a Bang & Olufsen.
Yeah,
you can get a Bang & Olufsen H6 within the same kind of price range that you can get the Beats headphones. You can get,
whether Apple and whether Apple's Beats subsidiary will continue to make products that are better and better. I think that's probably likely. I think they're going to continue to make better products because there is, obviously, if there's competitors that are making better sounding headphones at a similar price target, Apple wants to be competitive. But if you're talking about premium in terms of just straight up expensive, I think there's the market, you know, if you look at the bell curve of the market, it goes down pretty quickly after you start getting past where Beats is selling.
Sure, I'm talking totally about quality, and
okay,
not price point. I'm talking about within the same price range, anywhere from $250 to $400 kind of thing, $250 to $450 basically.
Yeah, definitely. I think Apple's going to work harder at making increasingly advanced headphones that are not only sound better but also, you know, lighter and more comfortable and better materials and things, because, you know, Beats was kind of considered sort of lower end materials.
Definitely. Well, let's wrap this up. I've been talking to you for an hour and so. What are your parting thoughts when you think about summarizing this event for our listeners?
I think it really shows how little value there is in people who talk about what Apple's going to be doing before they do it. There's this huge desperate rush to, you know, try to say everything that Apple's going to come out with.
Careful, because that's what we do here on the Apple Insider podcast.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about things that are happening, and because there's an awful lot of our readers that care about whether or not they should buy things. Should they buy things now or should they wait? But there's a difference between trying to have a sense of like what's happening, what's in the pipeline, and just trying to say, you know, here's everything Apple's going to announce like the day before. It's kind of like a spoiler ruiner, which I don't think there's that much value in it. But also, there was such an effort to, it almost seems kind of malicious. I mean, part of it is just trying to have recognition for things, but there were a lot of key things that Apple introduced, and we didn't even talk about the whole Nintendo thing. That's kind of a big deal that Nintendo's making devices for iOS or making apps for iOS now. But that was not anything that anybody guessed about. And you know, if you talk about the material value of news, it would have been nice to know that in advance, if you're going to print rumors, that Nintendo's going to do, because I could have invested in Nintendo and made a bunch of money. But nobody, that was the secret that Apple got under the radar.
And, you know, and it has made a bunch of money for Nintendo. Their price went way up.
Yeah. I wish I would have thought of that. Because, you know, Nintendo's stock went up dramatically when Pokemon Go came out. And one of the things I wrote about that was that actually Nintendo is not getting that much money from...
Yeah, they have a lot of...
Actually, Apple's making more money, or, you know, comparable amount of money, because Apple's making a third from the App Store and Nintendo is making something less than that from just licensing their stuff. And here, Apple or Nintendo is going to be actually producing the application. So they're going to be making the other cut outside of the App Store of sales. And it's not a subscription thing where people are paying for, you know, whatever you pay for in Pokemon Go to keep playing it, the in-app purchases. That's going to be a paid app game. So people are going to be paying to play Nintendo, the Super Mario, not Super Mario Go, is it Super Mario Run?
Yeah.
So Apple is going to be clearly benefiting from a third of the revenues generated by this sales of this app. It's going to be a big deal, I think.
I'm sure of it.
No one's even giving any attention to Apple for pulling this off. And then Nintendo stock goes up dramatically. And it's like, well, I hope it's successful for Nintendo. I was also kind of starstruck at the event. I was standing outside and, you know, here comes the guy from Nintendo. And I'm just like, whoa.
What, Shigeru Miyamoto?
Yeah. And he's standing there and, you know, they're talking and I'm just like, whoa. And I'm thinking, this is kind of cool. I've never even thought I would see in person. Here's this guy. I could just reach out and touch him. And he develops these Nintendo games. And then I turned around and Angela Ahrendts is behind me. So I was like, oh, wow. I'm surrounded by influential people.
Very cool.
That kind of flesh in the face.
Very cool. Well, Dan, thank you so much for going to the event. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for putting together the podcast. You do all the work on it. It's great.
where can people find you on the internet?
I'm on Twitter at Daniel Aaron, E-R-A-N. And I'm also lately have been taking over Apple Insider's Instagram. It's @AppleInsider_official. So you should follow our Instagram. We just started posting things. So if you like to watch, if you communicate graphically on a social level, that's one thing to follow. And of course, there's also Instagram. Twitter. Apple Insider on Twitter is just Apple Insider.
Fantastic.
And of course, I write for Apple.
Oh, that too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Dan, and we'll be back next week with all the latest news as we find out more about the iPhone 7 as it begins to launch. This has been the Apple Insider Podcast, episode 85. Thanks so much for listening, and if you found it valuable, if you enjoyed listening this week, please make sure, it helps us out a whole lot, if you go to iTunes and rate and review us. We really do appreciate the good ratings, and I want to thank the people who gave us ratings last week. It was really, really nice to read those, and I appreciate it very much. I'm going to read them. In fact, we had some nice ones, so I'm going to give some call-outs here. Hold on a second.
It's always nice when people post nice things on the internet.
Yeah, well, it is.
It really stands out because most of the people who comment are complaining or, you know, excessively rude about
the internet comments.
Small typo or something.
The internet comments so everywhere are made of complaints. But I want to say thank you to a user by the name of Shuping, Shuping, who wrote, "This is my fix. Apple Insider is my go-to." Josh Holm wrote on the iTunes store, "Great for Apple fans." Molly M54 said, "Timely topics," and said that we did a terrific job of guiding the conversation. a user whose name is a long string of numbers that begins 172748589696930. Goodness, I don't know how you ever remember that, said, I like this podcast. A great listen each week by PMZDJ and great show by AKA Tony Starks. So we had a number of people who were very kind and thoughtful and gave us great reviews. And I want to thank them. And please feel free to give us great reviews and you know, tell us where we mess up too. But I really do appreciate it. Thank you so much. This has been the Apple Insider Podcast, episode 85. We'll be back next week.